there, briefly. I have one. If you need one, another one, see me after class. I've got an original I'll give you. This table is what I call an addendum. We've spent the classes thus far, getting out of the first century right on through what would become the Roman Catholic Church, all through a period of apostasy, and we've covered roughly going on 1,500 years in the course of that. As we talked about at the beginning, the digression, in one sense, didn't take very long before people were moving. In fact, moving away from the Word of God. In fact, you can see even in the Bible that movement starting to occur. And the warnings came with it. It didn't take long to start, and as time went on, it wasn't too many years before it had gotten to the point where it was largely an apostate church, as far as what history, secular history, has to record. But at the same time, it was not a dead in the sense of stop with the digression they were with, at the point they were, rather it just continued to digress. And that's really, this table is sort of a summary. A lot of this stuff we've seen, we've talked about, to just give you a two-page overview of some of the major changes that happened over time since the first century up to what we're going to be covering in lesson 12, that is the beginning of the Reformation. And you can see as time goes on, while there were some changes in organization early on, it didn't take very long once people got away from the Word of God for the digression to be really unconstrained. It could go wherever it wanted to go. And I think you see that in just looking at some of the things that show up over a period of time in this table I've given you. One thing that I wanted to point out particularly, because I didn't know what it was and had to go back and look it up, and that is on the second page, you will read in the third line down, baptizing bells. And if you were to mention, if you read that, you think about baptizing bells.
I mean, like
a bell, ding, 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 dong, ding, dong. And on this addendum in chat in lesson 11. Okay. Baptizing of bells. And it's funny, I was looking at the Catholic question page on the web today, and it does have the stamp of approval from the Catholic Church. And the way they explain this is that this really does go on, but the innuendo is that it's the sacrament they're giving. So there's a distinction made between sacrament, that is the baptism we've been talking about that Catholics perform, which has something to do in their mind with not only salvation, remission from sins of inherited sin, but it also carries with it this inward grace. And they'll say, well, they won't deny they baptize bells, sprinkle, I guess, in most cases. And but it's not the sacrament, so that makes it okay. Don't try to.
But what is it?
They make them holy.
Purification.
Yeah, something.
Yeah. Right.
Basically, it's a, make them holy, make them, as far as I know.
Well, priests will do this today. I mean,
It's still going.
They'll sprinkle water on ships and
everything to bless them.
Yeah.
But that's different.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
But they won't call it, they don't call this. They call it actually, they actually will admit this is baptism. They classified as baptism. It's just not sacramental baptism. Anyway, that one just kind of struck me as strange. If you ever do want to find out how the Catholic doctrine will, how they will approach answering a question, there are a number of questions in this so-called Catholic answer box, I think is what it's called. And you can find all kinds of stuff in there. Okay, lesson 12. Believe it or not, we are in the finally making it to the transition, at least, and then into the Reformation. As you might imagine, as we talked about the other in the other classes, as we made it up to these last few centuries, the Catholic Church. And it's the hierarchy when I talk about the Catholic Church, had reached a point where, A, it was powerful through land acquisition that had happened over time. It was also powerful because of the role they had with respect to the state. So it was rich, it was influential, but it was also extremely immoral. And so one of the factors, major factors, that comes into being during this period and causes of this Reformation was just the general immorality of the hierarchy. And people saw that. And one of the ways, and they basically weren't accountable either, so one of the ways it was talked about, and we'll see one example of that at least, to get the posts under control was to move it out of the closed system and appoint councils to name the pope. And so that was one approach that was going to be pursued, and it didn't last very long. There was also, and we saw some of this in the last couple of classes, there was also nationalism that was coming on the scene. These invasions that had come from the north down into Europe and Italy had sort of given way to development of various kingdoms, and country boundaries were starting to get created, and people had a degree of nationalism, and therefore they thought the Pope ought to go back to Italy, ought to stay in Italy, rather, as far as his influence. There was interest in this mysticism, and mysticism in this case had to do with it was mysticism as we normally think of it, but the focus was on individual relationships to a god or God. And so more of that was coming on the scene, so people were branching out, wanting to get out from underneath the system, the hierarchy of the church. And then another one was just plain old humanism, individualist. This is going to be a period of education coming into being, greater education to the people. Of course, we'll see the printing press comes along. For some time, people had been involved in being in a feudal system. They had no power over their lives, and they started to break out of that. And so that would be another factor that got into the Reformation, the causes of it. There was another teaching, set of teachings or ideas that came out that also influenced people, and in fact, in a way, influences us today by, through the government we have. And names are not important. There's a couple guys in the early 1300s, and they were teaching that the church ought to become more democratic. Now, the thing about that is elite, educated, were starting to talk in terms of democracy, which would mean a lot to us eventually in terms of the country we live in. But they also moved that into the church, how the church ought to operate. And the positive about that, of course, the church is not a democracy as they really were thinking about it, but there was an aspect of it that it was, and that is they were promoting the idea the church ought to be selecting its own leaders, instead of the system that was in place at the time. So that had an influence. Those ideas started influencing the people of this time. Okay. So that's sort of an overview of some of the things were going on that were bringing about change, and we'll see that as we go through the lesson today and other days as we're given time. And we see some examples of that and how some of these things actually unfolded. With regard to the clergy, I think we talked about Boniface III. Was it Boniface III? I think it was. And being the peak of papal power. But the popes are still powerful at this time. Here we are approaching the 1500s, late 13, 1400s. Boniface VIII, who was in the latter part of the 13th century, was the last one of the really strong popes. And he's got an interesting history in that what was attributed to him, they say he came in like a fox, ruled like a lion, and died like a dog, which I thought was an interesting comment. And the way he got into power, supposedly, is every night he drilled a hole, put a hole in a wall to the bedroom of the then pope. And every night he'd whisper through this reed, he'd put a reed through it, and he'd whisper through this reed, "You need to step down." And he did that over and over and over again. Pretty soon the guy thought God was talking to him, and he resigned.
Wow.
And for this fellow to get the position of pope, he ended up bribing the cardinals, or those who were selected, and got the election to the pope. And he ruled with an iron hand while he was ruling. But he went to the point, remember that we've used this metric before, about a third of the land was owned by the church at this time. The impact of that was the kings could not get taxes on those lands. And they needed the money to run their government. So they started taxing the church. Well, needless to say, the church hierarchy didn't like that. And so Boniface excommunicates, particularly the kings of France and maybe England as well. And he then tries to turn the tables on them. And we actually, I think, quoted out of this papal bull that he gave that said, "We pronounce it as altogether necessary to salvation for every human being to be subject to the Roman pontiff." So he demanded that everybody was going to be subject to him. Furthermore, he said, the pope can judge the kings, but only God can judge the pope. So we've got this political power play going on. In this case, Boniface, actually, it was his undoing. He got what is called the Babylonian captivity. He ended up being taken by the king of France, up into France, and it ended up that he would become answerable to the king of France, and he was beaten, he was humiliated, and basically lost his mind, and so he died in that situation. So the statement about him going out like a dog, where that came from. And so in 1303, he was dead. From that time, there are different counts depending on what events you associate it with, but basically the next 50 or 60 years, the Pope resided not in Rome, but in France, in Avignon. And it was an era that I mentioned was talked about as the Babylonian captivity from their standpoint. Well, Italy wanted to bring the Pope back, needless to say, during this period. And so there comes a time when there was a fellow named Gregory, Pope Gregory, returned to Rome and to try to set up the papacy there. And in doing so, when he went down there, he ends up dying there. So the people of Italy try to convince the cardinal, the College of Cardinals, to or Council, whichever it was, it was College of Cardinals, to elect another pope to replace him to stay in Italy. And so they were forced in their mind to do that. They did it. In the course of doing it, the guy they appointed, Urban VI, didn't pay them any heed. And so they felt they'd been pressured, so they appointed another pope, and a fellow named Clement. And Clement takes the court back to Avignon, France. And so you've got two people claiming to be Pope, and in fact, elected by the same group of cardinals. And this goes on for a bit. And finally, Paris suggested that a council be called to solve this problem of having two popes. So they call a council, and they appoint another pope. Well, that gives us three now. And in the course of that, they all excommunicate one another. So you've got, and in fact, the first two have been deposed. So you've got these two that are deposed, and yet they don't step down, and the third one who is wanting to serve as Pope in France. And there ends up being another one of these guys, the guy that was elected to replace these two, ends up being taken over by his, he dies and somebody else goes in his place. And again, it ended up then having another council being called. They eliminated all three of those popes and they appoint a fourth one. And I go into that kind of detail to point out something to you. Remember, the popes have their, by Catholic doctrine, have their lineage back to Peter. And I know the infallibility aspect of the Pope. And of course, at this point, they don't claim the Pope to be infallible, but they would. And they would say it's infallible ex cathedra when he's speaking for the church. And yet these people, that's exactly what they were doing. I don't care what you call it. They may not have given it that official title, but that's exactly what they were doing. And they were as prone to mistake as any man could be. And they're just plain old immoral and corrupt. So in any event, you have this last pope, and they continued in France to try to fight this for some period of time, between this battle. But eventually, the pope does go back. Rome does take it over. And in fact, Pius II ends up issuing another papal bull that says there will be no more selections of popes through councils. He said that will not be allowed anymore. So that was supposed to stop that. Pope Innocent VIII, in your notes, seven or eight illegitimate children, and he was active in trying to get financial reward through various means for his children. We've got Pope Alexander, who you may recognize, and I didn't bother to go back and refresh my memory on the history of this person, but Lucretia Borgia is a name that comes out of history, apart from anything religious. It's interesting, the Catholic Encyclopedia calls Alexander the worst of the popes. And in his case, he was, again, like some of these others I've listed for you, lived a very immoral life while he was pope. He served under five popes in his lifetime. It was how fast they were turning over. And not only that, he bribed 25 people to get the pontiff position on his own, and ended up having six children by a couple of women. And remember, of course, they weren't supposed to be married, but he turned around and put his illegitimate children in church offices and et cetera, and he got afraid that his own son would take his life, and that was a problem with him. So he had, politically, he worked the system. Morally, he was as corrupt as they come. Pius followed after him, Pius II. These sort of interesting stories about what these guys concentrate on. I remember, these are head of the church, supposed to be. And Pius II came from a noble family, but didn't care a bit about morality. What he was skilled in was writing. So he produced histories. That's how he spent his time. His history, interestingly enough, was put on the index. Remember, we talked about these two tools that the popes used to bring the Reformation under, trying to bring the Reformation under control, one being the Inquisition and the other one being the Index, as books of Bibles, books that the faithful were not to read. Well, his history's got put on that list, as a matter of fact, and the reason is because he was suggesting the council, in fact, ought to be selecting the Pope, so they didn't like that too much. Julius II, listed there, followed sometime after him. He was a warrior pope, and his issue was making, you know, he raised an army, and he really drilled and went out, and, you know, he just basically was a commander. That was his lot in life. And he also had illegitimate children and bribed to get in the office. Leo X came after, sometime after him, right after him, and he was a member of the wealthy family, and when he found out that he had become pope, he said to his friend, "God has given us the papacy, let us enjoy it." So you get a, you know, you kind of get a picture, or try, hopefully you do, of the nature, the character of those who were supposed to be the spiritual leaders at this time. And, you know, they were anything but. The next thing I wanted to cover was these indulgences. We've talked about indulgences in some of the classes, and they became common during this period of time. And going back, just a refresher, if you wanted to be, you know, the idea of, yeah, you repented of your sin, whatever that sin was, and there was forgiveness to be had in heaven, but you had to make some kind of recompense here on earth of a temporal nature, and that got to be what the indulgence was. And it's interesting how they would sell these things, how they describe them. For a certain amount of money, the Pope would draw on his treasury of merits in heaven and apply the goodness that had been built up by the departed saints in his treasury and apply it to your sins. That's the way they would explain it to people. And remember, you're dealing with a population. This is one of the places where the education, having access to the Bible, comes into being, makes a big changes. You're dealing with people at this time without any education. I mean, they're just they're farmers. They're coming out of a feudal system, and so you can say things like this, and the church is held up in such high esteem that people say high esteem. They're dependent upon the church, and so they're going to listen to it, and like it's God's truth, which is
thank
not.
God for Gutenberg.
Sorry? Yeah, thank God for Gutenberg and printing press, no question. You could purchase, I think somebody's mentioned this in class, you can purchase indulgences to get somebody out of purgatory early. And what would, and when they'd have crusades, you could. You'd volunteer to go on the crusade, you would have your sins forgiven, you wouldn't have to pay indulgences anymore. That was your indulgence. Okay? You know, it gets exaggerated as time goes on. This is one of the means by which they were raising the funds to build Vatican City, or St. Peter's Cathedral, literally. The trade, indulgence was a business. I mean, you had indulgence salesmen, one of which is this fellow, John Tetzel. But they got a commission. It was a commission salesman. And you typically got, they typically were to get 10% of whatever they collected in indulgence. And some of the stuff I read said probably Rome was lucky to get half of it. So it went in all kinds of pockets along the way. And eventually this boiled down to, or evolved into the point, not only did you come and confess your sins, buy an indulgence for the forgiveness of that, but they'd sell indulgences futures indulgences. They'd sell indulgences on sins you hadn't even committed. So you could buy indulgence and then live however you wanted to live. Just plan on it. And that,
you're covered.
Yeah, you're covered, right. This is the state of affairs on these indulgences. This fellow, I'll talk a little bit more about Tetzel because he's going to be a major player in this commercialization we were just talking about. He was Dominican prior, and he was he was given the job of being an inquisitor. And these are kind of interesting hand-in-hand jobs, being an inquisitor and the overseeing all the indulgence taking in Germany. And I guess if you played your cards right, you could, if somebody wouldn't pay up, you could also torture them or threaten to get them to pay up. So it was he was working both sides of the railroad track. But he would be, because of at Luther's time on the scene and his time on the scene crossed paths. And so he was his behavior was a major factor for Luther's reaction, which we'll talk about later. Another corruption that came in was simony. And simony was the idea of having the clergy pay for their office. And it takes it, you can imagine where it gets its name from, Simon the Sorcerer, and paying to get be able to do the miracles. And this thing became very lucrative for the church. I mentioned Leo a moment ago and the building of the St. Peter's Basilica. Leo was making best I can tell, this is in their dollars, was making $1 million a year selling offices in the church. And that's a lot of money today, if that's right. And of course, the man who bought that, it was a lot of money. It was a lot of money then. It's a lot of money now. But it would be even more, a lot of money right now if it was on an inflation basis. And what would happen is people, of course, had no interest in the office necessarily. I mean, the office per se. The office was the means by which they could charge people and get money. And people would buy these offices for their children who were going away to school. So when they were away to school, they had a means of having funds come into them through their activities as being an officer of the church. And this was the way this thing was used and why it was so corrupt. I made a statement a while ago about education and lacking. There's one thing I had read talking about using this for scholarships. Men were willing to pay the money to the church to get that office so they could send their kids to school, because it was like one in 10,000 people could read or were educated at this time. That's how bad the education was. And of course, people have been, for a long time, the Catholic Church had taken the Bible away, that the people had not had access to the Bible on their own. Another corruption is hagiolatry, which is, and we saw a little bit of this early on when we talked about the relics way back when. And this became, officially, the term itself has to do with worship of the departed saints, but it would move on also to relics. And what happened with this, it wasn't just a case of worship of saints. It was the idea that saints could give you something back out of that worship. And so you had nuns, what we call nuns now. I don't know what they call them then. I guess probably the same thing. They pray that their sins might be hidden, pray to saints that their sins might be hidden. Merchants prayed for a rich haul. I mean, it was it was a superstition in play in this kind of worship. There's a statement made by Erasmus relative to the relics. I think Greg and Lauren probably saw some of the evidence of this when they were overseas. Erasmus says there appeared to be enough wood from the true cross of Christ to make a ship. So many relics, pieces that wandered around. At one time, there were 5 shin bones of the ass on which Christ rode into Jerusalem. So that gives you an idea of how these things were played up and used. It's no different today. It's the same. Mentioned they weren't people were not educated. One of the things that comes about in this time frame is a term we're all familiar with, the Renaissance. The idea of a rebirth is the literal meaning of it. And people started to move out of this feudal arrangement they'd been in. Futile and feudal, both. Started to where the really during that period the church was the whole center of their life, and they started coming to light to them that they could have a relationship with God without that, or without that dependence that they've had. And so the whole idea of humanism, and humanism in a right sense, not to the kind of humanism in the negative sense we're accustomed to in this day and age, although it had some smacks, some inkling of that as well. People started to realize the wealth of the worth of the individual, that there was a means of having a spiritual relationship with God without depending upon the Catholic Church. And so that started to cause them to move out. The downside of that, they started going back and studying some of the classicals, like the Platos, et cetera. And if you remember going all the way back, it'd be hard for you to forget. You go back that far, and all this Gnosticism, et cetera, that was going on, they also got involved in that as well, or at least in the immorality aspect of it. So immorality actually in some cases was glorified as opposed to fought against. So the Renaissance had a major impact. The events of the Renaissance had a major impact during this period of time. A fellow by the name of, it's not really that important, Pico Mirandello, mid-1400s, late-1400s, he was a scholar, and he emphasized the dignity of man and started making the point that he had the power to choose what he wanted to do. And he could choose evil or he could choose good. And so that emphasis on will also would come into play through the developments that they go on during the Reformation. And then finally, just the nationalism, the growing nationalism we've talked about a little bit. So that's the scene set, the environment in which people were living during the 1400s, leading up to really amongst the time frame that you have some of these Reformation forerunners come on the scene. The Reformation officially, I guess, started with, historically official anyway, started with the nailing of the 95 Theses by Luther. And that marks in history the date of the Reformation. But you've got all this going on, and you've got a couple of people we'll talk about here who are in the midst of it, and you always already have a Reformation underway, or the seeds of it underway, in Wycliffe and John Huss. Okay, any questions about that kind of stuff? Chris?
Do they sell?
Yes.
There is not the
financial indulgence, to my understanding. There are things you have to do penance, but they are generally just acts of showing forth something. It's not you need to contribute $100 or something. That's my understanding. Anybody got anything better? Okay.
Doesn't the Mormon Church require the members to give all that they have when they first become Mormon?
Requiring tithe for you to be able to go into the temple. I don't think it's everything.
No, they tithe.
Oh yeah, there's a special. Everybody can go into the temple, like you say. You have to meet some kind of special requirements.
That's just one.
Get to a
You can't go in there, I can guarantee you.
I've been in there,
buddy. Have you?
Before they opened it up.
The one here. I was talking about the one in Salt Lake.
I'm talking about the one right over here.
Yeah, here. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Before it was baptized.
That was very interesting.
I bet it was. We wanted to go to the one in Salt Lake when we were up there, but of course you can't get in that one.
What did they do?
They had an open house.
A secret password or something? They actually had the ceremony where they bless it and there's some songs and stuff, and I don't know all the details.
The local, you know, when they did the local one. To get into it?
I was there about a month ago and I saw it on the way to the airport. I was like, I wonder if you can get in there.
You have to be a Mormon. Start off with, and I don't know what else you have to do to get into it.
How do they know if you're Mormon or not?
You probably have something to show. You can't go in the tabernacle.
No,
you can't go in the temple.
And even all Mormons can go in there.
Really?
I mean, yeah. Like a 32nd degree Mason or something. I mean, yeah, in there an hour.
Really?
Yeah.
I was in Salt Lake one time, and you can't. In Walter, near the church, but you couldn't really go very far without being confronted immediately. And the reason I ask that is that this girl told me that she had, when she became a Mormon, given everything that she had to the church, which was not much. It was a car and a few possessions. But she and they saw the altar, and the church saw the altar.
That's not. When I did Mormon study, I sure didn't run across that anywhere at all. Tell Marie Osmond that, Donnie Osmond, they need to fess up.
Well, I can't remember on the papacy and all the corruption. I mean, you've got a certain captain's cycle that calls one plus one of the worst. How do they deal with it? How can the church answer back to having all these popes and multiple ones at the same time? And going back to Peter and infallibility, how do they address that?
I don't know.
Very careful.
I don't know.
I guess just like their crusades, they say God rules.
I might go ask that. I'm sure they got a defense for it because they've been faced up to it for years and years and years.
That's what I said. They haven't done encyclopedias and criticize them and all that, but they're infallible and they're God's spokesman. How can they say that?
They go back to, they make a very, today at least, there's a very sharp line between what a pope does and what a pope does ex cathedra. Very sharp. Very few things the pope does comes out ex cathedra, as I understand it. Very few today.
And that's the only infallible part?
Yeah, I guess what they hold, what it is, that's the way they define it. So he can be as rotten as he wants to be.
How do they just find an immoral people is head of their church? Is that the same answer as rotten?
We're all sinners.
Immoral people in the church.
What can I tell you?
May as well be headed.
Yeah, I don't know. I've not tried to understand or go back and research their rationalization because that's all it would be. I can imagine what some of them are.
You know,
it'd be their rationalization. No, there's nothing rational about it.
I think it's more
cultish than anything.
Well, I think my experience with my family and being Catholic, the thing is tradition. They just don't rationalize.
The way it is.
Just tradition. Calvinism. I mean, how many people who are in Calvinistic-based religions really know that it's based on Calvinism? I mean, I don't think they question it. It's like Rock says, it's tradition. You accept it. Questioning it is bad, I think, on some level. I mean, I know a lot of people, you know, Baptists, they don't know anything about Calvinism.
Yeah, what's happened in today, I think a lot of what's happened in the denominations is that the vast majority of them have moved to a social, at least the major ones, have moved to a social gospel.
Absolutely.
And doctrine is really not an issue. It's a feel-good, social. I mean, it's not to say they don't study, don't ever open the Bible, but it's just moved that way.
It's going to be Romans 13:1.
Sorry?
It says, let every soul be subject to the government authorities, for there is no authority except in that from the government.
And?
Well, they're in authority.
Which ones, the government or
the
Pope?
No, yeah.
They're different.
They are in a position of authority.
Yeah, they're in authority.
See where they would rationalize. They're there because God allowed them to be there.
Yeah.
Well, that's why, even in England anyway, the people, you know, if they had a bad king, the kings were thought to be anointed by God or appointed by God. Or that was their God-given right to be kings because they descended from the king. And nobody would question anything they did just because they were the king.
Could
they
be the king?
Could they be the king?
And you see, and of course, in today, in our environment, people question the Catholic Church all the time. Well, they don't question it so much, they just ignore it. I mean, Catholics. It gets outside of, when I say people, when you get the people in the States that are maybe they're more affluent, maybe they're impacted by it, the ones that have lived here all their life, more impacted by the culture. You know, I don't know what all the factors are. But clearly, I mean, you, whether it's birth control, abortion, I mean, it doesn't make any difference what it is. There are a lot of Catholics that don't follow Catholic leadership on those issues.
The ones few that I know, I mean, it tends to be a far more emotional atmosphere than doctrinal based or even logic based, reasoning, any of that. You know, I mean, you can't get, you know, two words in to start asking questions and, I mean, they're shutting you down. I mean,
yeah, I think we've used the term in here that there it has a certain atmosphere, or whatever. There's this at this stage that tends to be what you see, at least what I've seen. I've mentioned it here that one time my cousin I tried to talk to, and you know I'd have a few conversations back and forth with her. But every time I did, and I was, you know, she'd come out, she'd been baptized, was a member of the church for a period. And when you talk to her, she would take, she'd listen to what you say, but the next thing you know, she'd go see her priest. And then all bets were off. You know, and the Vatican Council said this. No, you can't say that. That's not true anymore because the Vatican Council changed that. Now, you know, you got to the point where it didn't matter what the Bible said. Okay, Lord willing, we'll pick up John Wycliffe. Sunday.
I was wondering, you think it was God behind Gutenberg,
in front of
everybody getting...